And at that time, this is K2RIW. Check that at this time. See if I've got the normal amount of audio in both places. Got more audio on Sheldon than I do in Glen Oak. Main reason the TechNet exists is a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about how wireless equipment works, and they want to know more about the 27 or whatever it is, different kinds of ham radio gathered here on Sunday night for the last 30 or so years, 35 years if this is, 36 years, and teach each other what they've learned. The books and the classes do a mediocre job of teaching the real ins and outs of how wireless equipment works. Let me drop. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. Call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in just because you're listening. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. It's like 1982. 37 years is going on. 36 in the fraction years. Second part of the TechNet is run by Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy runs the science talk and the mailbag for people who don't yet have their right kind of license and they want to communicate with us. So they get a message to Roy, and he brings those messages to the net, and we discuss them. The third section of the net is where Paul, WS2N, tells us what's going on with the space report. And Paul's got some new insight about a launch that he'll be telling us. So, I'll drop for a second. So now we're going to go to that first section. Wish the audio was a little bit louder. Check if I've got the... Oh! I didn't have my... on my transmitter. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, if you do have a question or a comment. So a typical sign-in will sign like this, AC2GS, Roy, and yes. So, give me your call letters right now if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
K2RLW.
And K2RLW, you're supposed to also give us your name. I'm guessing it's Bob. I'm guessing it's Bob. Is that true?
Name is Bob, Big Ocean Bacon.
Okay, we got you, Bob. Who's the next person to sign in to the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name with the word yes if you do have a question or a comment.
NBB, Bob, yes with a question.
We only heard the tail end of that one, Bob. NBB, November, Bravo, Bravo. So squeeze your mic, wait a couple of seconds, and then give us the prefix. Back to you, NBB.
Sorry about that. That was Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo, Bob, with yes with a question.
November, Victor Bravo. Okay, we got you, Bob. So we got Bob number one and Bob number two. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Give me a call letter and a name right now.
N2EO, Vic.
Okay, that was a mysterious guy named Rich. We got him. Anyone else assigned in? Give me a call letter and a name right now. If that was someone trying to sign in, they were much too noisy and we didn't hear anything. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we got more than enough to start. We'll start with Bob number one, K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. I said a call letter is fairly similar to mine. Go right ahead, Bob, K2RIW, you're in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. This is Bob, K2RLW, and I'm just signing in because you asked me to a couple of weeks ago, and I've been listening each week since the repeater has been working well, and I have no particular questions. That is your form of physics. So back to you, Rich. Hey, this is K2RLW standing by.
Very fine, Bob. Nice to hear from you. And I've been getting a number of letters these days from people who have been telling us they've been listening to the TechNet for quite a number of years. I wonder why we get some funny voices on the TechNet. Only when I talk. Well, why don't we find out what's going on? The next person who signed in was Bob number two. Kilo
Dick, and hi everybody on the net. This is Bob, KD2NVB. Yeah, I just got a question that, you know, I got to do some experimenting to find this, and it's very likely something I can do nothing about, but I have a very poor HF antenna situation. I bought a magnetic loop, and the one thing I can do with it is I can barely get onto the Kings County Radio Club 10-meter net, which is more often than not run by Roy ACGS, AC2GS, and I always, the place that's best for my antenna in my very bad apartment that has chicken wire in the walls and such is the same place that I get the most, it's just AC hum. You know, it's like a pitch between B and B flat, which is the AC 60 hertz frequency, I believe. And the same place that has the most, the best signal to hear the people is also where that hum is loud. And today it's particularly loud. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions of where I could start in the experimentation. Maybe if I'm lucky, I could put ferrites on the coax or, I don't know, something like that. There's already a built-in ferrite core on the part that goes to the coupling loop from this chameleon antenna, magnetic loop antenna. Anyway, any suggestions about that? That's my question. Back to Ned.
Yeah, that is a bit unusual. Magnetic loop antennas, usually people claim that they're considerably quieter, and you're picking up a lot of hum. The input line to your magnetic loop antenna, why in the world is this thing making these sounds? I'm hearing some crazy squeaking sounds when I talk, coming out of the repeater. I'll eventually find out what's going on. Oh, I'll try changing power level. That doesn't seem to be doing it much. Oh well. Physically, what does your magnetic loop antenna look like? How big is it? What bands does it cover? I think you told us the brand name, but it went by kind of fast and I didn't catch it. So tell me what it physically looks like is number one. And the input transmission line, does it go to a small loop? And does that small loop have a variable capacitor? Over to you, Bob. KD2NVB, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KD2NVB. Yes, it's a small magnetic loop. It's, I guess that's roughly 3 feet in diameter. The small coupling link loop does not have a variable capacitor. It's just the standard, I think the way they make a lot of these small ones, it's just a large variable capacitor on the main loop, on the big loop. What else can I say? Oh, it's a chameleon F-loop 2.0, and I'm using the what they call their high efficiency. It's kind of a couple loops in one. I'm using these aluminum radiators that are supposed to be more efficient than the coax ones, which I also have, but I always just use the aluminum one. So, let's see, what else did you ask? Yeah, that's basically it, of your questions. So again, it's a chameleon F-loop 2.0. Some viewer people out there maybe are familiar with that.
Bob, where you mentioned the word aluminum radiators, I'm not quite sure what you're saying. Can you buy it made out of more than one material, copper or aluminum? Or did you homebrew something out of aluminum? The aluminum radiators you mentioned, what was that? And give us some more words on that. Over to you, Bob.
Yes, big deal. Yes, it comes with, it's all bought from the manufacturer. Instead of the coax, which they also have, there's another option. They have these different connectors, and it's in two pieces, and it's a hoop made out of aluminum. I'm not sure of the exact type. They call it aluminum. They'd probably say more if I looked it up. And just for the record, the inner coupling loop is also aluminum. That's the way they do it. So, yeah, back to you, Dick.
Okay, I think you're saying the outer loop, the main loop that's roughly 3 feet in diameter, is aluminum. Did you have the option of buying that out of some other material, like copper? Was there more than one option along those lines? Back to you, Bob.
Actually, it was the plus model. The plus model means they included these aluminum option, aluminum two-piece hoop that hooks onto this. Without the plus model, it would have just been the standard coax, which I also have because it's more portable if I wanted to carry it places. So, that's the only option, is the aluminum, adding the aluminum or just having the coax. Back to you.
When you're using the aluminum loop, the option, the plus option, does the aluminum get added along with the coax, or does that get added instead of the coax? Over to you on that one, Bob.
Yes, Dick, it's instead of the coax. It's one or the other. And there's three options, because you can do the standard coax or the aluminum, and those give you, to answer your other question I forgot to answer before, it's 10 through basically 40 meters, but it's, you can also do the double coax, which is up to 60 and 80 meters. I'm not doing that. Just, the aluminum just goes through 40. And so, yes, it's instead of the coax.
The one that goes to the lower frequencies, you said it has double coax. Does that mean the coax makes more than one turn? Back to you, Bob.
Yes, it makes more than one turn. Maybe I should have left that all out because I'm just using the aluminum. But I don't know. I haven't tried it if I would have the same problem with that, but I wouldn't be using it on 10 meters. But anyway, this is a problem on 10 meters with the aluminum. But yes, the one that makes up to 80, that's just two loops of coax, you know, doubling it up.
Now, once you've got a magnetic loop, the majority of people will set it up so that the plane of the loop is parallel to the Earth. That gives you horizontal polarization when you do that. If you set the plane of the loop perpendicular to the Earth, then it radiates in the plane of the loop. In other words, if the plane of the loop was, let's say, east-west, the main signal coming out of your loop would be both vertically polarized, and you'd have a main lobe to the east and a main lobe to the west. So have you experimented with using it in the vertical mode as well as the horizontal mode? Over to you on that one, Bob, KQLIW.
Yes, Dick, I've only used it in the vertical mode, meaning it's, you know, the loop is, yeah, I've only done it vertical. It would be kind of tricky. I haven't mounted it on a camera tripod, and actually, maybe I could. I could do it. The balance point would be tricky. It might fall over. Anyway, I've not tried it in horizontal mode. It's just vertical, and I do turn it to get the best angle, and like I was saying before, the best angle for the signal is also the strongest for that hum, which was even stronger today than usual, and I could hardly, deal with it today. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
Okay, you have been using it vertical, and you've tried various orientations. Have you discovered that when you orient it so that the plane of the loop is in the direction, in other words, it radiates edgewise, it doesn't radiate broadside. Have you noticed that the stronger signal is when the loop is edgewise to the direction of the signal you're listening to? Have you made that discovery, Bob? Go ahead.
Yes, I actually knew that from reading and such. And so when I point it, you know, I'm just turning it where it sounds the best. And so I'm assuming it's on the plane of the loop. That's the direction that the signal is coming from. I'm not always completely aware of exactly, you know what I'm saying. So I do know that it does on the plane of the loop. And I find the best signal just by turning it and seeing how it sounds. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the reason I'm emphasizing this, Bob, is that you know better, but an awful lot of people fall into the trap of thinking that the magnetic loop gets the strongest signal broadside. And for a short period of time, I was even saying that on this net. I had to correct myself the next week. Have you also noticed that in the plane of the loop, it'll pick up the desired signal in two separate orientations, 180 degrees apart? So in other words, you could make the forward edge of the loop, so to speak, directly toward the signal, or the forward edge of the loop, so to speak, the exact same point, exactly opposite. It radiates in both directions. Have you tried the other direction or 180 degrees apart? Over to you, Bob.
Again, KD2MVP, yes, I've tried that. And again, I also knew that from reading and researching before I even bought it. But I did turn it 180, and yes, it was basically identical. So I'm aware of that. So I know. So use most of the time, I don't bother to experiment more than 180 degrees of, you know, difference back and forth.
Out of curiosity, when you listen to the two different positions of the loop, 180 degrees apart, is the amount of signal and the amount of hum identical in both of those directions, Bob? Go ahead.
Well, Dick, actually, I didn't specifically try that. If there's a possibility that it could be different, I didn't think it could be. So I don't think I had consciously tried that. So I'll try that. We'll see. I have not consciously tried that. Back to you.
Yeah, whether or not that's going to be a benefit is a bit of a long shot. Now, the word hum, you're going to have to give us some words on that. If I was picking up 60-cycle raspy noise from a pole pig transformer or an insulator from the Con Ed wiring that was breaking down, that has a particular characteristic sound to it. Yes, it's at a 60-cycle rate, but it's got a raspy sound. If you looked at that on an oscilloscope, it would look very spiky. A real pure hum, if you looked at it on an oscilloscope, would have nice round sine waves. From your recollection of what you heard, the hum that you're hearing, is it the round, single, sine wave type thing, or does it have a second harmonic in there, like 120 cycles, but rounded waveform, or is it the spiky kind of 60-cycle noise that you hear from local man-made stuff? What kind of, describe the hum a little bit to us, Bob. And KD2NBB, K2RAW.
Yes, it's actually, I think it's a very round hum. It's a real hum, and it's like, and it had, definitely had harmonics. I'm a musician, so I picked this stuff up pretty easily, trained ear and stuff. And I mean, there were harmonics I could pick out, like the seventh, which is, I don't know, that's a fairly high up harmonic that's maybe an octave plus a minor seventh higher. And there were others. It was a very resonant, round hum, not raspy. Back to you, Dig.
Yeah, that's a tough one, because the magnetic loop is supposed to be very immune to that kind of stuff. Since I think you're operating it on a tripod, have you tried it in more than one location? If you're doing it indoors, have you tried it in the living room, the bedroom, the kitchen, and so on? Have you tried it in different locations to see whether or not the hum can get better or worse? Do you have local fluorescent lighting anywhere nearby in the ham shack? Over to you, Bob, K2RAW.
Yeah, I moved it around, and like I say, when the places where the hum goes away, so does the signal. Like, I have a small two-room apartment, and my radio and stuff's basically in the bigger of the two rooms. It's like, but the best place is the bedroom, but of course, that's where the hum is. So I it could be like a neighbor's thing, like, because neighbors are very close, right through a fairly thin wall. I mean, something like that. I don't know, and I do not have fluorescent lights, but maybe a neighbor does who's just through the wall, or, you know, who knows, that kind of thing. So, yes, I've moved it around, but like I said, the best place for the signal is also the loudest place for this hum. So, and when I turn the antenna, the hum and the signal get the strongest at the same point. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, when you aim it in the direction where you get the strongest signal, is this just one particular signal you ever listen to? If you listen to other signals that come from other directions, when you aim the antenna in that other direction, does the hum come up the same way with that other signal? Over to you, Bob.
Well, Dick, unfortunately, like I said, I have quite bad reception in my apartment. It's basically what some would call a Faraday cage with old walls that have wire and stuff. And I've picked up very few other signals. Nothing to really compare it to, but on a few occasions when I picked up like 20 or 40 meters, or even when I'm going around and I'm hearing the standard noise you hear, I'm not hearing that hum. I only remember hearing this hum when I'm on this 10-meter frequency with our Kings County Radio Club 10-meter net. That's all I recall. I don't recall hearing it any other time. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, now we're getting a couple more clues here, Bob. You hear the hum on 10-meter signals when you're listening to the Kings County 10-meter net. Do you hear the hum on any other frequency, even though the other frequencies are very weak signals because of your Faraday-shielded apartment? Is the hum only on 10 meters? Do you hear the hum on other frequencies? Over to you, Bob.
Well, Dick, I'm not sure if I would. I haven't noticed it, but I haven't done much searching because when I'm on the net, I just stay there. And a few times I've moved around, and I don't recall hearing it anywhere else, but, you know, I'll have to just experiment with that in mind to make sure. On the 10-meter band, maybe it's in other places, and maybe it's not. I don't know for sure, but I don't recall ever hearing it anywhere else. Back to you.
Okay, with reference to the 10-meter net, Kings County, have you ever listened to them on any other kinds of antenna? Dipole or Yagi or whatever? Have you ever used any other kind of antenna? And on that other kind of antenna, do you hear hum? Over to you, Bob.
Quick answer, no. I don't have any other antennas that pick up HF. Yeah, so no. Only this loop. That's all I've got right now for you.
Now, you've got a bit of a mystery there, Bob. That shouldn't be happening. That's a tough one. And is there fluorescent lighting in your neighbor's house? You would be getting further or closer to that fluorescent lighting if you operated from other rooms. And so, in the room you're in now, you get the strongest signal in Kings County and also the strongest hum. When you go to other rooms, the signal is weaker and the hum is weaker. So it sounds like the signal-to-noise ratio of that hum to signal is the same no matter where you listen to it. Is that roughly true, no matter where you locate the antenna, Bob, K2LIW? And by the way, the hum also gets very weak when you aim the antenna in a direction where you get a null on the desired signal, is what I think you told us. Back to you for any update on all of the above, K2LIW.
Again, I can't really say for sure because basically when I go anywhere else, with no signal, no hum. So in a sense, you could say yes to the same because they're gone. As far as where they're, you know, they're buried under all this other standard kind of noise. And yeah, as far as, I don't have to, like, with all your questions in my head, I will experiment more with more, you know, precise concentration and more methodical. But as it stands now, I don't think I can tell you because I think it's basically there's very small places where I get any signal that I can hear the voices at all, and it's the same place you get a hum. So back to you, Dick.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. By the way, your audio became a little bit lower on the last transmission. I'm not quite sure why, whether it's the repeater or if it's some change in your transmitter, and maybe you're talking into the back of the microphone, so to speak. I doubt it, but I'm just mentioning it as a possibility. Huh. Shouldn't be happening, and that's a tough one. And the everybody claims that a magnetic loop is a lot quieter antenna. It doesn't pick up man-made noise as loudly. Most people claim that it's superior in that manner, and you're discovering the opposite. Let me toss it over to the net. Does anybody listening to us tonight have any suggestions on what could be causing Bob's hum on his magnetic loop antenna, his Chameleon, I think is the brand name, FLoop210, I think is the model number. Anybody got any suggestions as to where the hum he's hearing could be coming from? Give me a call with us if you've got any information that would help. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, quick correction. It's the F-loop 2.0 plus. So anyway, back to you, Dick.
Now, thank you, Bob. Looks like nobody else has got any suggestions. You've got an unusual one there, Bob. And I sure wish you had a 10-meter mag mount antenna, 10-meter dipole. You could construct a 10-meter dipole rather easily out of any old pieces of wire that are, let me think now, I think a half-wave dipole and 10 meters is 16 feet long. To squeeze it in the apartment would be a little bit difficult, and the 16 feet of wire for the dipole and 10 meters doesn't have to be out straight. You can zigzag it and make right-angle bends in it, whatever. It'll still resonate and still work about the same. So, even if you don't have the wire out straight, to construct a 10-meter dipole on the end of a piece of RG58 coax would be an interesting experiment. Does it have more hum or less hum, or the same amount of hum? Is the hum really on the signal in your environment? I mean, if the hum is by some means getting onto the signal in your environment, then picking up the signal is going to be picking up the hum is going to be the same, so to speak. But that's a strange one. I guarantee that Kings County is not intentionally putting out a hum, somebody would have been complaining to them a long time ago. And if I understand correctly, this magnetic loop, the highest band it can be used on is 10 meters. It doesn't also operate on 6 meters, does it, Bob? KD2NVB, K2RIW.
K2RIW, I want to comment. Has the guy tried listening to half the frequency at 28 megahertz, like on 14 meg? And to see if something occurs there also, because it might be a multiple of something like the clock frequency out of a UPS, which he might be listening to, possibly. Just a thought.
Yeah, that's worth a try. We've given Bob quite a number of experiments he's going to be trying. But, so, operate on half the frequency, 14 megs, even if there's very few signals, it's worth a try. Does the loop also work on 6 meters? I'm a little bit afraid it probably does not. Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KD2NBC. No, it's not, doesn't go above 10. It's, doesn't work on 6 meters. So I guess what Joe was saying is I could go on, like, 20 meters and get exactly double the frequency part. I'm getting a harmonic or something like that. Back to you, Dick.
It's worth a try. There may be some strong source of signal on some lower frequency and you're listening to upper harmonic of it. It's a long shot, but it's worth a try. For the time being, Bob, you have stumped us. It should not be happening. Magnetic loops are famous for not doing things like this, and yours is doing it. And if you can borrow any 10-meter antenna from a buddy of yours, construct a simple wire dipole on the end of a piece of RG-58 coax, even without a ballon, and the wire itself that you make that's 16 feet long, whether it's small diameter, large diameter, it doesn't matter. And whether you've got a simple piece of string as an end insulator, doesn't matter, and so on. So I'd love to see what happens with any other kind of antenna except a magnetic loop. So right now, you've stumped us, Bob. Back to you for any final comments, and hopefully you'll get a chance during the week to run a number of experiments and report back to us. We'd like to hear what else you discover. KD2NVP, with one hell of a mystery. K2RIW on the TechNet.
WS2N, one comment.
Go right ahead, Paul.
I looked up the antenna. What's that box do? It's, you know, that loop is all tied into a box where the coax goes into. What does that do? Could something be wrong with that box radiating the noise inside of that?
I'm going to guess that's the tuning mechanism. Over to you, Bob, to answer that.
Yes, that's the big tuning. I mean, it's like casing, the housing for the tuning capacitor. And it's got different connectors. Paul might have noticed that. That would have been a little more confusing because, like I said before, it's got standard the connectors for coax. But then it's got these other connectors that you connect the aluminum radiator that I'm using right now. So, yes, that's what the box is. And I was going to say one more thing. I do have some wire I got before I got an HF antenna just to see if I could receive stuff. So I'll try using that for, for seeing how the 10-meter it sounds on that, at the hum signal and all that. That's another thing I can test without buying anything extra right now. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, where you're using the aluminum loop, I'm a little worried that aluminum can build up aluminum oxide and make a less than ideal contact. Any possibility of the connection between the aluminum loop and the variable capacitor box assembly, cleaning up those contacts using emery cloth, sandpaper, steel wool, or whatever. No, don't use steel wool. Steel wool on aluminum gives you a funny compound. So sandpaper, emery cloth, or even scraping it with a knife, just to make double darn sure that the aluminum is making very good contact to your tuning box. It's a long shot, but it's also worth a try. Back to you, Bob. NVB, K2RIW.
Okay, I could try that. I have some very, some light, small gauge sandpaper I use for sanding saxophone reeds, making them a little less stiff. Anyway, it's quite a new loop. I've had it for a couple of months, and I've never, had it out in the weather and stuff, so I couldn't imagine it'd be a problem. Also, I've heard people ask about that aluminum oxide issue, and the people that make it or other people that defend it say it's a certain type of aluminum where it's not that big a risk. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know anything firsthand. But I could try the sandpaper. Yes, I could do that. Back to you, Dick.
Once again, it's a long shot, but it's worth a try. Even though the antenna has not been out in the weather, aluminum will build up aluminum oxide just sitting on the shelf. And for all you know, that antenna has been sitting on the shelf for 6 months before you bought it. So cleaning up the contacts, worth a try. All these other antenna experiments and locations, whatever. You'll be gathering more information that'll give us more hints. So right now, you've got a bit of a mystery. And let's see now. Roy and I, sometimes we give out a prize for somebody who stumps the technical net. So you're a candidate for the great big prize. We haven't yet told anybody what the prize is. Good luck with your experiments, Bob. Okay, the next person who signed in was Rich in 2EO. N2EO, K2LRW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. A couple of things I've learned from you, and I'm trying to pass it on to the powers that be that are building up the new repeater here on 8-5. I've suggested to no avail to all like an advanced receiver research preamp. About a 10 or 12 dB noise figure and about a 0.7 dB, no, 10 or 12 dB gain and about a 0.7 dB noise figure. This is a 3M201 MOSFET. Go lower in noise figure with a gas set. But I think that might be a little risky if there's any leakage coming out of the duplexer on the beam side. I wonder what your thoughts are. Andy said to me there are issues. I don't know what issues there could be. I understand way the... I may be wrong, but as I recall, there was a 30 dB gain Motorola preamp. And you know a lot of professionals, not amateurs, think that gain is all you need. All you need is enough gain to override the noise of the second stage and a low noise figure preamp. I think you'll agree with me, Dick.
There's some yeses and nos on that one, Rich. First of all, you want to put in a preamp on the current repeater to make its receiving sensitivity greater. A worthwhile endeavor, but there's a catch. First of all, does it really need it? By Andy and Lou using their service monitor and various other devices, they can measure what is the real sensitivity in dm or microvolts of this particular repeater, and that'll tell them right away whether or not they stand a chance of getting much improvement with the preamp. That's one idea, whether or not do you really need it, and good laboratory measurements first will tell you do you really need it. Now, of all the possible preamps you could put into that location, the Advanced Receiver Research preamp is the worst. It's a beautiful product. If I installed it on my receiver at home, it would work like a charm. However, if you've ever looked at the method of construction of the Advanced Receiver Research preamp with its gas fed preamp in there, it is not a well hermetically sealed box. It's got an upper plate and a lower plate resting up against an aluminum ring that is the that makes up the box, and just screws hold that together. There's no finger stocks around the edge. The amount of shielding of that container is such that in a rich environment near a repeater, and particularly this particular repeater, which is a few feet away from a 10 kilowatt FM broadcast station, no way in hell would they survive with that particular preamp in this location. There are preamps you can buy. Let me drop. There are preamps you can buy that are in an extremely well-shielded box with sometimes double shielding, you know, inner layer and an outer layer and so on. And they might need that in this case with very fancy feed-through capacitors. The signals that can be picked up outside the box, outside the coax connectors, are something you've got to worry about. They need 120 dB of shielding in that particular environment. So there are lots of people who have, on a repeater, tried using that preamp. Almost none of those people were successful. That particular brand and model number of preamp on a repeater, because of the amount of shielding you need that it doesn't have. So first of all, when they make the measurements, they'll find out, do they really need a preamplifier? And if they do, they're going to be very careful to select one. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. How about the lunar link? How about that one? Which one would you recommend? Finger stock that's sealed. And all you said is on a 6-meter radio, a Heath kit, SB110 on one side. Now, it had a new Vista front end. Not a transistor, a new Vista. Was sensitive, but not great. I was able to get the sensitivity with a service monitor down to the point where I could still hear a 0.1 microvolt signal.
WB2ZOC.
WHOR, would a comment on this subject also?
Yes, he recognized and Joe recognized. One of the brand names that makes a pretty well-shielded box is Engel Linear, Chip Engel in California. I'm holding on to one of his boxes right now, and it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 4, 8. It's got 10 screws holding down the top cover, 10 screws holding down the bottom cover. That's a much better shielded box with type N input and output connectors. So there are preamps out there with enough shielding where they stand a chance, but I don't think there's anybody who has been able to use the Engel Linear, the Advanced Receiver Research preamp, in a state-of-the-art repeater system. Steve, go right ahead, K2RIW.
Yeah, Joe's probably going to comment similarly to what I was going to say, or I'm going to say. I've only got a few minutes, but Rich, in a high RF environment, you only have so much usable receiver sensitivity you can get because of the other transmitters on the site. And unfortunately, over the last 40 years of having tried that, I have taken the Advanced Receiver Research preamp and put it on the shelf. If you're the only guy there, you stand a pretty good chance of making a significant difference. And as Dick pointed out, there are a lot of other better preamps, but if the noise is there, you're going to bring the noise level up as well as the desired receiver signal. Let me hand it back to Dick, and he can hand it to Joe, WB2ZOC.
Very fine, Steve. Okay, Joe, WB2LYY, go right ahead.
WB2LYY here. Pretty much similar to what Steve said. At a high-density comm site, it's very difficult to put a preamp on things because of two things. One, your simple transmitter noise from all the transmitters up there put out energy on your receive frequency. And if this becomes above a certain level, you think if you stick a preamp on a receiver, you're measuring what a service monitor, and you think, well, wow, I put the preamp on, I get a 0.1 signal for 20 dB quantity. You may get that off a signal generator. And as soon as you take that receiver combination with the preamp and put it onto your outside antenna port of your duplexer, everything changes dramatically. I've done tests at home and found that even up on VHF and UHF, on my home installation, I have a moderate noise floor. It decreases. I've been running a repeater on the air for well over 30 years. At that location, I have a good duplexer, but the duplexer by itself is not enough. I have a 1 megahertz bandwidth filter in front of the preamp to give the thing some much better noise selectivity, plus or minus the Kent Center frequency. That will only keep out-of-band transmitters from overloading the preamp. What it will not do, it will not stop on-channel energy from getting into your receiver and getting amplified. That's what you have to determine first. If you don't know that, putting a preamp on is a big gamble and probably a big waste of time. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I agree with that, Joe. You can be getting an awful lot of noise of adjacent transmitters with an extremely good pre-selecting filter as well as the duplexing filter, which sometimes is required. Sometimes you can knock down that noise. And when you add a preamp, you're between a rock and a hard place as to what amount of gain you can add to that preamp. Everyone thinks that the overload characteristics of the preamp is something you've got to worry about. In most cases, that's not it. You add 20 dB of gain in a preamp, and the third stage downrange in your receiver system of your repeater will go into a high signal overload and give you all kinds of grief. So as you add gain, some stage is going to go into saturation a lot sooner than it ordinarily would. So adding more gain can give you a lower noise figure, but it gives you more saturation. Less gain gives you less saturation, but not as much improvement in noise figure. And as I said, you're between a rock and a hard place. It's a very difficult trade-off decision as to what amount of gain you want. In some cases, the amount of gain you want might be 7.5 dB. Can you buy 7.5 dB of preamp gain? The answer is not easily. And if you just take your preamp and detune it so the gain goes down, well, you destroy the noise figure in the process. So one stage of preamp made with a good FET transistor gives you something in the vicinity of 20 decibels of gain. In many cases, that's too much. It's going to overload something downrange 20 decibels sooner because you've added that preamp, even though it's giving you one whole dB of improvement in noise figure. So 1 dB of improvement in noise figure, but 20 dB of detriment in overload is not a very good trade-off, if you know what I mean. In a rich environment, these are some of the things you got to juggle, and it ain't easy. It takes a lot of experimenting, a lot of testing, a lot of head-scratching, a lot of talking to your buddies before you find out what's really going on. Were you going to add something else to that, Joe? Is that why you gave me a little bit of a carrier? RYY or whoever, KQLIW?
No, I was done with my comment. I don't know who else was there.
Okay, so you've got a good-sounding suggestion there, Rich, but nowhere near as easy to do as you would suggest, as you think. And right now, the guy setting up the new repeater got a number of other things to solve. They got a slightly taller pole to in the tent to solve first before they get down to the ultimate insensitivity of the receiver. N2EO, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Well, I guess it's definitely, I didn't realize. I know on my home station, years ago with the Yaesu FT221, I used an advanced receiver research preamp and used on a repeater, but I understand why. But on my home station, boy, did it do wonders.
I believe it. Your home station radio-wise is nice and quiet. You don't have 15 other repeaters within a few feet of you. You don't have a broadcast station with repeating to you. When you turn off your transmitter and you're receiving, there's nothing around you except maybe a little bit of power line noise down the street, so to speak. So the fact that it gave you such an improvement in your environment is good, but in the environment where this repeater is located, it's a much more severe environment, a much more critical environment. Let's see if we've got anybody else with any further questions before we leave the question and answer section of the TechNet. If you've got a question or a comment for the TechNet, give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, there being none, time to go over to the mailbag and the technical talk of Dr. Roy, AC2GS. AC2GS, K2RIW. You got it, Roy.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dick. By the way, Angle Linear, I think, is out of business. Their website says back in 2017 that the president has decided to go fishing.
My goodness, I'm sorry to hear that. However, Chip Angle turned out to don many of those. www.angelinear, A-N-G-L-E-L-I-N-E-A-R.com. He turned out so many of these, I guarantee some of them are going to appear on any of the used equipment locations. You search around, you're going to find somebody that's got one, particularly if they've got one with a blown gas fet. And replacing the blown gas fet is not too difficult if you're a little bit handy with that. So getting a hold of one of these, if you fell in love with it, is still possible, even though he's no longer manufacturing them. I'll bet you he's turned out 5,000 of them at least. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Yeah, I've never had the joy and the privilege, but that they look like they're bulletproof. They're very, very sturdily built devices. So, I agree with you. Hardware doesn't disappear just because the company goes out of business. It swaps back and forth and sideways, and that's why God created eBay, I guess.
You got it. A person who wants one bad enough will find somebody that'll allow him to beg, borrow, steal, buy, whatever. You got it right.
Okay, very good, Dick. Thank you. As always, I like to remind people, and as many times as I remind people, some people tend to not realize or forget. If you have any topics that you'd like me to cover, any questions you'd like me to answer, anything in general, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at my call sign, which is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. And anything and everything that I talk about will be on my link on my website. In addition, I have a space report link that Paul gave me, so you can check it out now. And after I finish my little talk, I will add my links. And that page, as always, is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. Before I start my own spiel, if anyone out there has any science questions, feel free. Consider this the open opportunity to hurl them at me. So if anyone has anything interesting, please feel free to hit the push-to-talk button and tell me.
W-2-Y-Y, I got something for you.
Okay, Joe, hit me. I wonder if it's as interesting as the last time with... That was a particularly interesting fine structure constant question. Yes.
No, it's much simpler than that. And this goes back to the thing that Dick said, no question is like too dumb to be asked on the TechNet. Okay, well, here goes the question, and I don't really know the answer, but if you think it's a dumb question, you can laugh with your microphone not keyed and have a good time doing it, okay? All right, here goes. There's a sport called, I think it's called curling. You've probably seen it. I don't understand much about it. But they take something that resembles like a five-gallon gas can made out of metal. I don't know what the structure is, what the thing is. They run this thing on the ice, or start propelling it on the ice. But what my question is, you get two guys in front of this thing rubbing the ice like crazy to try to keep the thing running in that direction. What are they doing to the ice to make this thing do that? Back to you.
Okay, Joe, I am not an aficionado of the sport. I think it's kind of a Scottish derivation, and I think they actually do it in Canada. Right? I'm not aware if we do it much in the United States. My guess of what's going on is they are applying friction to the ice in order to melt the top surface. The way that skating and other things work is that the pressure of the blade compresses the ice and raises its melting point and produces a slick lubricating layer of water right above the ice so that you can slide around. But before that puck or whatever they call the curling device can reach it, it really is not doing that. So they probably use friction to warm up the top surface layer and make it slick with a very thin lubricating layer of water.
Thanks. Well, there you go.
The actual object that's moving, Joe, is a very precisely engineered piece of granite. I believe it's granite. I don't know its exact weight, but I think it's a healthy 20 or 30 pounds of granite with a great big handle coming out of the top of it. So it's a hamburger-shaped piece of granite, about 20 or 30 pounds of it, and they launch it across the ice. It's got a smooth bottom, and they get a small amount of steering by the guys waving the brushes out in front of it. And so, crazy game, and hasn't caught on very well in the United States, but I do see it on Canadian programs. When I had satellite television, I could watch Canadian programs. It was popular there, and I think it's also popular in Scandinavia. I'm not sure whether or not it is an event that's in the Winter Olympics. Maybe Roy knows that. AC2GS, K2LIW, go ahead, Roy.
I do not believe so, and I might be incredibly wrong. For anyone interested in details, the bowl is usually around 36 inches in circumference. About 4.5 inches high and weighs anywhere from 38 to 44 pounds and is often, as Vic said, made out of granite.
WS2N.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's a winter Olympic sport. They call it a rock. That's what they call it. They wrote a rock. Or pushed a rock. But, and like Joe says, they're out there with the brooms. Just trying to, I guess if they rub it hard enough, it curves it a little bit one way or another. And then they got to get into certain spaces, knock the other guy out, kind of like shuffleboard. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I don't really follow the Olympics, so I wouldn't know. But it strikes me as a very strange sport that involves brooms. say anything else, Joe, about the incredible sport that is curling?
No other questions. I guess if I want to know more about it, I'll have to Google it, but thanks for entertaining it.
No problem, Joe. Anyone else with any kind of science-type questions before I do my own little spiel?
WS2N, if you watch Jeopardy once in a while, Alex Trebek will talk about it. He's from Canada, and he likes that sport.
Canadians are interesting fellows. I watch a lot of YouTubes, and especially about electronics and such, and I'm always amused. They use the word soldering, which is the English pronunciation of soldering, and there's a whole bunch of interesting little vowels that they tend to use that Americans don't, which is, probably they would be annoyed with me calling us Americans because they're on the same continent. But anyway, Canadians, fun guys, they really are very friendly. If they like curling, so be it. It's just I don't understand that. But okay, we all have our little idiosyncrasies.
I watch it. I watch it for the reason Joe watches it. I like the physics behind it. It's amazing.
Okay, so do you follow billiards too?
Just pool. If they're playing eight ball on TV, I'll watch it. Not billiards.
Okay. They all work in based on physics. Some have more of it than others, spin and other such things, but I don't know. I just read physics books instead of watching competitions. But then, different strokes for different folks, as I said. Anyway, anyone with any other questions, comments, topics, or what have you before I do my thing?
Right. That's how a lot of young people in the 1960s and 70s got to learn basic physics, playing pool. You got used to all the different possibilities. What the ball could do to you, angle of with the angle when you hit it on the one side and it's going to pop off on the other side, angle of attack equals angle of whatever it was. it's an equal angle, that type of thing. If there's two balls there and you hit one ball, the other only one ball is going to move. They're connected. Or if there's 10 balls together and you hit one ball, only one ball is going to move. Basic physics. It was great.
Question.
Yes, Wesley recognized it. I just wanted to say that, I agree with you that obviously sports involves moving things. A lot of times circle balls. And so there's a lot of kinetics and there's a lot of Newtonian physics going on. Some people, clever people, realize exactly what's going on and sort of learn all these things. Others just kind of learn it by rote and what they can expect. One of the things, though, is we're kind of evolutionarily designed to kind of have the ability to figure out Newtonian physics somewhat, because it's a survival method. You want to know if something is running towards you, you sort of want to know how soon it's going to get there so you can evade it and such. Unfortunately, when it comes to quantum mechanics physics, it leaves you completely bare naked because it has no relationship to what we see in billiards or any kind of sports. It makes no sense. If you can imagine a baseball tunneling to home base without passing between where it came from and where it's going. So much as far as physics. So, Wesley, you wanted to ask a question or make a comment?
Yes, I do. Wave front. How would you explain wave front, what it is?
Well, I would assume the general explanation is it is the front portion of a propagating wave. Now, are you alluding to pilot waves, which is a way that people try desperately to explain the duality of quantum wave and particle duality, or are you just talking generically about wave fronts?
Well, technically, wave fronts are plane waves, so they are planes. How about Dick? What would you say about wave front?
As a signal, a radio signal is emitted from an antenna up close. If you could slow down time and if your eyes operated, you would see a bunch of bubbles. You would see spherical bubbles that are expanding at the speed of light, but you slowed that down so you'd be able to see them. So if you had a transmitter, you, at the instant you turn it on, you'd see a bubble coming out of the antenna, and you'd see that bubble getting larger and larger in diameter. The next sine wave would have another bubble inside the first one, and the third sine wave would have another bubble inside. See, you'd see a whole sequence of bubbles inside of each other, all of them expanding outward at the speed of light, all of them separated by one wavelength from each other. That's one way of saying what you would see if your eyes operated at radio frequencies. As you get far enough away, the bubbles get larger and larger in the diameter, and therefore the amount of surface that you see gets flatter and flatter. And by the time you get in the real far field of the antenna, let's say a mile away, that although it really is a spherical bubble going in all directions in space, the section that you're looking at will look like it's perfectly flat. And there's no way around that. If you've got a uniform medium through which the signal is propagating through, that wavefront, particularly if it's in free space, is a perfectly flat wavefront. And now, your particular receiving antenna, let me drop. In order for your receiving antenna to have maximum performance, you do whatever's required to give the antenna within the physics that you've got to operate with. You want your receiving antenna to have a particular apparent physical receiving area, and you'd like to maximize that area, and aim the antenna in such a way so that the effective capture area of your antenna lines up with the flat wavefront that's coming into it. And how much energy you absorb is strictly a function of your effective capture area. If at your particular range, your particular signal happened to have a flux density of, let me pick a number, 1 milliwatt per square meter, and if your receiving antenna had an effective capture area of 1 square meter, then when you took the output cable from your receiving antenna and plugged it into a power meter, you would measure 1 milliwatt of continuous power when listening to that CW signal. So this gives you a little bit of a feeling of how I think a wavefront would look, why is it flat, and how does it behave when it intercepts an antenna. And everything I've said about the receiving characteristics works perfectly well for transmitting, because almost all antennas, almost all radio waves, and almost all medium, with rare exception, obey the law of reciprocity. Whatever gain and pattern and polarimetry and whatever that you get in the receiving mode, you have the exact same characteristics in the transmitting mode. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much for this part of explanation, but you didn't explain why those wavefronts, compared to the planes, they are perpendicular to the direction of propagation and to XGS.
The usual way this is taught is the so-called pointing vector. Every radiated signal, which is linear in polarization for simplicity, if the wave was, for instance, vertically polarized, our standard is such that the E field is what determines polarization. So if the E field is vertical, the H field, the magnetic field, will be horizontal. For a whole bunch of complicated reasons, the E field and the A field, H field must be exactly at right angles to each other in a normal medium, in a normal uniform isotropic medium that the signal is transmitting through, particularly free space. And the so-called pointing vector tells you how strong is the signal and in what direction it's traveling. If you do a vector multiplication, it's called E cross H. In other words, if the E was at 12 o'clock and the H is at 3 o'clock, and you do what's called a cross product, E cross H, you're literally, in your mathematical analysis, rotating from 12 o'clock toward 3 o'clock, and you're standing behind the antenna when you do this, and that's the signal that's being radiated. E cross H is a clockwise signal by IEEE standards, and that signal will propagate in the same direction as a right-handed screw thread that's being rotated in that manner. So this gives you a little bit of an understanding of why E and H are at right angles, and what determines the direction of propagation. That signal that has been set up for